Welcome to Bookbinding Now, Susan Mills' bi-weekly New York-based podcast series about all things book arts. My name is Miriam Scher, and I'm a lecturer at Columbia College Center for Book and Paper. And I'm here with Peter Verheyen and Karen Hamner. Peter's the preservation librarian at Syracuse University and a binder and conservator. Karen is an artist, binder, and educator, but we're here tonight to talk about the Bone Folder. As a lot of you know, the Bone Folder just published its last issue. So welcome.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hi, Karen. So one of the things I wanted to ask is how did you start the Bone Folder? What made you decide to do this initially?
Well, academic librarians and academic libraries, we're constantly screaming about the cost of cereals and things like that. There were, at that time, in the Guild of Book Workers Journal, they were fairly behind and issues weren't coming out, and they're mostly standards focused. And Danya Khan, who was working with me as conservator at that time, and I went to a brown bag series about open access publishing. Open access basically meaning freely available on the web for anyone to read at any time. And I'd been doing things online for some time, and she was kind of looking at me, seeing the wheels turn, hinting at, things like, you want to try this.
Right.
And we went back and forth a little bit, tried to figure out what would we need to do it and do it well. We wanted it to be respectable. We wanted to invite other people to contribute and participate editorially. And we decided to try to form this online journal and call it the Bone Folder.
Okay, now I know that you've said to me that it's based on the Bone Folder is based on Das Falzbein, which is from Germany. And I did actually a little bit of looking. You said it was 1927 through 1966, so it had a really long history. It started in the Weimar Republic and then went all the way through the 60s. And I found that really interesting. Were there other similar binding journals during this time all over Europe or even in the US?
I really have no idea. The Guild Journal was not out at that time, although the
Interesting.
Guild of Book Workers certainly existed.
Right.
I can't speak for England, but there were bookbinding publications, bookbinding journals, and that would actually be a really interesting conversation that someone could have with Jeff Peachy, because I know he's exploring those. There were other publications by bookbinding societies at the time. Meister der Einbandkunst, also German-based
Right.
but very international, had one. And there was the Allgemeine Anzeiger für Buchbindereien, which was kind of the general register for bookbinderies or the general newsletter for binderies, which published a lot of interesting articles. And many of those are popping up online through Google Books and the HathiTrust. But the Falzbein was interesting because it was specifically aimed at apprentices and people coming up in the trade, but then also was serious enough that it could really be used for lifelong learning.
Interesting. It's really interesting. Because I was really wondering about that. One of the things that made me think about it, I guess I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself, is that, since it ran through a very long political time in Germany, I was sort of wondering if you had seen any copies of it through the years and if the politics of the time entered into the journal along with bookbinding. And I'm thinking about this because of the article that I wrote and looking through some of the other articles. I mean, I really think the article I wrote had a somewhat political edge to it
It
that
did.
reflected the times. Well, it reflected the times that we're living in.
Sure.
And so I was sort of wondering, historically, it would have been interesting to compare these journals, but perhaps that's a
I don't have, and I didn't have access to that journal during that time period. But
Interesting.
I do have the Jahrbuch der Einbandkunst, which was published by the MDE, Meister der Einbandkunst, which were very heavy-duty journals, and they were published starting in 19, I believe, either 26 or 27, came out four times. The last one was in 33. And you could already see in some of the binders certain, even with students of Wiemeler, and people like that, you could see certain tendencies developing. I got it from Yale, but I also was able to locate a copy of the same publication for myself, both from, I think it was 1940, and then from the 1960s, basically an introduction to the bookbinding trade. And that was based on a German trade manual of the same of the 1930s. It was first published, different iterations. But when you look at the examples that they illustrate of the work, there was a lot of work, guest books, scrolls, desk sets that were done for political functionaries.
Absolutely.
And
that
so,
makes a lot
you
of
know,
sense.
You look at an exquisitely tooled binding with a really big swastika on the front and very Germanic script extolling one thing or another. And, you know, I'm not an expert on this, but during that time there were certain binders, artists who very much allied themselves with that side. And
Absolutely.
Others who decided that they weren't going to do that. And in the artist colony where I did my apprenticeship, the person I was apprenticed to, his father had been there. His
Wow.
father had done some books. There were other artists there who, if they weren't outright sympathizers and party members, were at the very least, you know, they went along with things and didn't rock the boat because they wanted to be able to do their
they had to
work.
Eat. Right.
Right,
They wanted to
exactly.
work.
But you look at some of the discussions, and I was able to get this history of this artist colony, especially during that time, and the politicization of art was incredible.
Right. It was huge.
And
it was a part of the agenda
sure.
of the regime, absolutely.
And I think it was the part of the agenda of just about every regime. If you look at
absolutely.
Stalinist Russia, Maoist China,
right.
you know, the WPA.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's what made me kind of think about that. Let's change gears a little bit and go back more, because I just really want to talk. That's something I was thinking about as I was preparing questions for us tonight. But in the beginning, we were talking, you had mentioned you had wanted to get other people involved in the editorial aspect in terms of the contribution.
In terms of the peer review.
Peer review. And that brings me to Karen. And I was sort of wondering when you got involved with Bonefolder and how did that happen?
I had an article maybe in the fourth issue, Peter, the third or fourth issue.
I think
the
so.
The flag one?
Yes.
Yeah, the flag book.
Yeah, I use it as a handout for my students.
Oh, great. I do too. It's really handy. I already have it written. So I wrote that article, and then I just weaseled my way onto the board.
Ah.
Since I'm not with an institution, it was attractive to me to have this group of colleagues, and I really liked the idea of the Bonefolder, how democratic it was. You didn't have to be a member of some organization to receive it, and really anyone could write for it, too.
It's really true.
I mean, peer-reviewed, so we...
Right.
We would review them, but anyone could feel free to submit, and people did.
Right. Where, you know, can you, did you always know the people who were submitting to you, Peter? Because I know you actively solicited me.
I did. You have something to say.
Well, thank you. And I was still actually at the time, really, I've been doing more writing over the years, but it was one of the first times anyone said, "Do you want to write for me?" And I thought, wow, I guess I could maybe do that. And so it was a great opportunity for me. But I'm wondering how, if that was typical, if you solicited people or if people submitted things to you, how did you know them? Were they, or how did they hear about the Bonefolder? Did you know?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. We did solicit. And initially for our first issue, we put out a call. And I don't remember how many submissions we got. I know that the appendix, which was published on education and training by Jeff Altepeter, that was submitted by him. But others were very actively solicited, especially at the beginning, because we needed to keep, you know, to build some momentum.
Sure.
But very quickly, people started just sending us things, and that
Interesting.
was really, really good. The other thing that, in terms of the solicitation aspect, was just keeping your ear to the ground. And, I hear from other people at times that it's very hard to find people to write for you. And I found just by monitoring the listservs that
Interesting.
people were always mentioning interesting ideas, interesting projects. You look at other people's blogs, you follow links, and you see things and say, I knew nothing about this. Nothing's been published about it. This could make an interesting article.
It was really great to have permission to ask somebody who was doing something I was interested in, will you write an article about this for us? Especially if it was a how-to and I wanted to know how to do it.
Give me
It
an
would be,
example of that.
Jim Reed Cunningham on his surface gilding.
Okay.
I'm sure I could think of others too. It would be kind of presumptuous out of the blue to email somebody and I didn't know and say, how do you do this?
Sure,
But
why not?
it was fine. Yeah, I might do that too. But it was not at all odd on behalf of the bone folder to do that. So I would solicit people I knew and people I didn't know. The Tomorrow's Past came out of me being interested in what they were doing, and I didn't know any of them.
And what is that?
This movement, mostly in Europe and the UK, of making contemporary bindings on antiquarian books.
Okay.
There was an article about it 2 issues ago, and the Bindorama in the last issue was our opportunity for people to try their hand at it.
Okay. And for those who aren't aware, the Bindorama is, you do that annually?
We did that annually, and we
Right.
started in our first issue with the spring back, which was something that Danya and I really had a lot of fun with. And it's an arcane style. I had just published with Danya an article in the new bookbinder and had also shared that through other means and workshops and things. And people responded to it. Karen made a do-si-do. Pam Berrios did something with pop-ups. I did one that was full vellum, but the spine was cut out so you could see the structure. There were others, and I think Danya actually did a miniature one.
So the Bindorama is kind of a call for everyone to make a book using a particular style, and you've done this over the years
Right. It was a
using various structures.
right. It was, and a big part of my thinking in it was, we introduce a structure. So, for example, Karen's flag book. And it gets people thinking about it. And by doing the Bindoramas, which were effectively non-juried and were published online, it gave people an incentive to try it. And I think people responded really well. There was some really interesting work that was submitted over the years, and people really appreciated it. And that is something that is going to continue, and I'm just going to do it as a regular part of the Book Arts Web.
Oh, that's really great. Because I think it gave people like kind of a safe way to like take a chance
Yes.
and try something new.
And I think people sometimes need a little nudge to do something, whether it's an exhibit or just some little reason to get started.
And it's always kind of great to have an excuse to learn a new structure because it's really easy. I know I do this, is I use the structures I know work for me. And so then occasionally it's really great to be thrown into a classroom or a workshop or something where you're like, okay, we're going to learn something new and incorporate it into my arsenal of things that I know. And I think Bindorama really afforded people the opportunity to do that.
Yeah, actually, if I'm going to do it again in the fall, at some point in the near future, sometime this spring, I should probably come up with an idea. So if you have any, let me know.
Cool. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about just some of the basic nuts and bolts. What year did the Bone Folder start?
2004.
2004. And how many issues were there?
There were 14 issues.
Wow. But in the last couple of years, it was twice a year initially, I
Right.
remember. And then in the last couple of years, you started to wind it down to
Well,
once a year.
I didn't think of it as necessarily. I was hoping it wouldn't be a winding it down, but it was. It had really grown, and I thought that if we did it once a year, we would have more time to really work on things in a more relaxed pace than killing ourselves twice a year. And I think the combination of doing that, but also still continuing to grow, made it very difficult and, ultimately on a certain level for me, unsustainable. Because for all of us, this was a volunteer effort. And, these journals for any of these organizations are really volunteer efforts. But it was also, there was a lot of production work that was involved. There was work not just on the editorial side with working with authors, but also all the layout and all those things. And that just with my day job, with my other interests and things that are also related to book arts, and sometimes they aren't, it just became too much. And, it was a very difficult decision and it was very bittersweet, but I would rather stop something on a very high note than drag it out and ultimately not enjoy it.
Did you ever consider getting somebody else to take it over?
We put out a call for volunteers for people to join the editorial board and did not really get any responses. Anne McKierney, who's works as a conservator at Albany, was the one person who really stepped forward and was willing to do work, and she helped out a lot with this last issue. It was her only one. But I think there's a lot of people out there who have good intentions, who are very interested, who support it. But when you start talking about production deadlines, fast turnarounds, things like that, they
Yeah,
start to have second thoughts. And
right.
that's
No,
not an unhealthy thing. I'm learning to say no too.
right. It is. It's a big commitment. Do you know how many times it was downloaded? That's a kind of interesting idea I was thinking of.
It's pretty close to 250,000 times between all the
Wow.
issues that we ever published over time.
Are those figures you send us periodically, Peter, available from the Book Arts web somewhere?
I posted the last ones, I think it was a week or two after
Oh,
the
on the
issue was
blog.
released on the blog.
Yeah.
I'm looking at it right now. The last issue has been downloaded a total of 4,824 times so far.
Wow. Talk a little, that's a good segue to talk about the blog. So, why don't we talk? I know that you, about a year ago, you started the blog.
We actually started an iteration of it about 4 or 5 years ago,
Oh,
but it
interesting.
never went anywhere because it was another one of those things like, and I'm just as guilty as anyone else. Oh, I have to write something, I have to find something, I have to do something, and it died.
Blogs are very demanding.
It's all demanding,
That's
but
true.
I try, especially going to an annual format, my thought was, especially with things like book reviews, it would give us an opportunity to get those out in a more timely way. If, somebody publishes an artist's book that's being editioned and it's really interesting, why not get it out there earlier? If, I mean, we had Oak Knoll and others send us books for review.
Oh,
You wrote
interesting.
a wonderful review of
Right. Well, I
Ed
did two reviews.
Hutchins,
Right. I did
right,
Ed
and
Hutchins
Richard
and
Minsky.
Jeminski.
Right, and being able to do that when the books come out is always a little bit nicer than having it come out a year after they're out.
Sure.
And so I thought of the blog as a way to get some of that more time-sensitive information out. It was also a tool for some of the lighter things that we got that might not necessarily have been appropriate for the published issue. But they
What,
were interesting enough to
huh?
want to share.
Like for some, maybe something that's not as large or
Yeah,
in
in
depth.
depth. Right,
Okay.
exactly.
Interesting. So the editorial board, is it going to contribute to the blog or are they just something that's going to cease to exist? It only took place in the bone folder.
I have no idea.
Oh, interesting. Stump the
Right
band.
now, I'm playing it as I go. I know that I have developed contacts with some of the publishers, and that they may well continue to send things. And if I get any of those, I will most certainly look and offer those books to people to write reviews
Oh, cool.
and publish them there. Sure, why not? If somebody writes an interesting shorter piece, why not? I think the more channels we have to share some of the really interesting work that's being done, ideas or start discussions. I could see tomorrow that the Tomorrow's Past concept, which I did not participate in this time, but I could see that continuing. I would like to see a continued dialogue about that tension between conservation and binding and the significance, artifactual or otherwise, of the things that we work on.
Well, I also think blogs are just so ubiquitous and such a great way of getting information. There's a lot of really interesting blogs of a variety of nature. I mean, anything you want to think of,
Absolutely.
not only book things, but there's a number of book blogs that I'm on there, RSS feed, and even though I am so not a conservator, I really am always interested to see what's on those blogs. Like, I get Jeff's all the time because he has really interesting things, and sometimes they really speak to me and things I could use, and other times they are more esoteric for my practice. But I don't think it kind of makes sense that the Bonefather would start as this one form and transform into a blog of sorts.
Transform might be a little strong.
Yeah. Just sort of like happen.
Evolve into,
Possibly.
shrink to.
All right. So, I have a couple other
Oh,
questions.
shoot. Go for it.
So I know you're not supposed to have favorites, but do you have a favorite article?
Oh, boy. God, that's a question I wish I'd gotten in advance.
Karen can answer this too.
Yeah.
I like the Tomorrow's Past article right now. I'd have to look through the rest of them and see.
Okay.
I like the article on Johnny Carrera's Pictorial Websters. I like the article on Gaylord Chanelec's Silva book.
That was
That's
a
a
really
great
good
book.
one.
That was a great
Yeah.
article.
That image of him walking off into the woods with his chainsaw is really fabulous.
Yeah. I like the one, I mean, I like most of them on a certain level, which is really a non-answer, but I think what I liked was how people reacted to them. And I'm thinking back to Joanna Drucker's article, which really started a wonderful fight on the Book Arts list. But it was a good one, and it really illustrated some problems. It's something that Richard Minsky and some others have articulated as well, and that is, where do the book arts fit in the canon of art history or the canon of the arts in general? And how does one discuss this? And book artists, by and large, I think it's becoming less so. But they're still by the mass of people. And, there's this strong reluctance to categorize themselves. There's this strong reluctance to ask to, or to, the strong reluctance to explain their work, why they're doing it. And I think if we want to advance as a field and to be taken more seriously, and more broadly, we have to be open to those discussions, and I think we actively have to seek out engagement with those who ask us those questions. And, Joanna's project, I think, was really, really worthwhile from a library standpoint because people are always trying to find these books. They are trying to search the history of it. You can have, and I think Karen's a good example of something that starts out as a concept. You have an installation around it. You have a text that goes with it. You have different pieces, but ultimately they could be considered part of the same work. And it ties them all together. And I think as I look out at what people are doing, there's a lot of pieces that could be looked at in that way. So, that's one example. And it's something that really, I think, made us think about what we're doing, how we're doing it, and where we fit in the greater scheme of things.
I think that's really important. And I know I teach in a graduate program at Columbia College, and something we're always trying to get students to do is to contextualize their work in the larger scheme of things. Whether they're making books or installation or paperwork or, printed pieces, about how to try and fit it into the larger dialogue of what's going on in the art world, past, present, and depending on what's going on in the future. So I think I see that, and it's funny, that's an argument that pops up periodically on the listserv.
Oh yeah.
And you do a great job of
Some
monitoring
some
it.
sometimes I throw the gasoline out, and then if nothing happens, I'll throw the match. But
Well, and
I think
it's
they're
good
good
to talk
discussions
about
to
that.
have. Right.
Absolutely. Were there any, well, that's actually, it's a little bit of a scandal. I was wondering if there are any, like, bone folder scandals or crises.
Go for it, Karen. I know you want to.
No, Peter said that I was the most brutal of the peer reviewers.
She was.
And
She made me
I'm
cry.
and I'm pleased that there were only a few times when there wasn't an article we couldn't work with and get into shape so that everyone on the board was content with it.
Interesting.
I feel good about giving people opportunities in that way.
I definitely agree with Karen.
And so I think I've run through a lot of my questions. So one of the things that I've been thinking about in terms of what we were talking about, in terms of the history and where you're going forward, you were talking about the blog, and that's like one step. Are there any other venues or directions that you can think of where people might turn for getting this sort of information?
Well, I have this fantasy that somebody else will take. Can't find the words, Mimi. Sorry.
It's
But
all right. I think what
that somebody
Karen's
else will pick up where we
right.
left off and
Right.
have some kind of publication that covers all the book arts, not just binding, not
Right.
just the conceptual stuff.
Right.
Not just the crafty stuff, something for everyone, and make that open access so it's available to everybody.
Right. And I definitely echo Karen's feelings on that. When I started it, we'd had fine print, which went on, I don't know how many years, but had ceased publication. That was followed by Tom Taylor's Bookways, which also went 14 years. And somewhere in the back of my mind, since I have the complete set and it's something I enjoy looking at, that was the magic number for me. 14. If you can do 14, you're doing good. I should say doing well. But anyway, but I don't, Gary Frost on his blog, published something about ceasing publication and basically, whether facetiously or seriously, throwing the bone to the College Book Art Association. And I responded to that a little bit on the Bone Folder blog. But I think my concern is there's a lot of I haven't seen the CBAA journal yet. It hasn't. It's
I don't know,
not.
has it come out yet?
No, it
I thought
hasn't. It
there
hasn't.
was a call for papers.
There was the Guild, the latest Guild journal that Kara Schlesinger is working on isn't out yet either. So, but I think she's doing really good work in updating the Guild Journal and making that much more compelling. But, and then there's the new bookbinder, and the Canadians are doing something
Yeah,
similar.
Cabbage's revamped combination journal newsletter is
I
really nice.
noticed it's doing well. And The problem with all of those, and it's not really a problem, is but they're all membership publications.
Right. Well, JAB isn't.
JAB isn't,
But
and
JAB is very focused on kind of analysis and critical thinking, more
it's
than being more broadly defined.
very true, and I subscribe to it. I
Me
really
too. And
enjoy
it's
the issues. It's
right.
incredibly well produced. It's always interesting. I like the interactive things that they throw into it.
A
But
physical publication is lovely, and we're book artists, and we all, the three of us,
right.
all make stuff you can handle. But it was awfully nice that the bone folder didn't cost anything.
And that was, it's amazing too, that it didn't cost anything and it was free for download. So you just had, if you wanted a hard copy, you could just print it,
Right.
print
And
it yourself.
I had an interesting conversation with Nancy Ravenel, who works with the American Institute of Conservation. She's their communications person. And she was curious to talk with me about my, it's much more mechanics oriented. How did it work? Here's what we're doing at AIC, and what could we be doing differently? And AIC has different specialty group publications. Some
Absolutely.
insist on paper, some
Really?
insist on mailing out CDs and nothing else because CDs are cheaper than paper. I thought that one was amusing. Some are considering online, but they're all very unsure about going out open access with that current issue. They do publish most of their publications openly after 3 years, but that's a pretty long time. And a lot of scholarly publications do that. That's completely normal. But I would love to see someone take it up. I mean, we had great interactions with the Australians, of all people, over the years. And that's something I never would have thought of. And it was a way to really, shrink the globe, if you will. We had readership from all over the world. South America.
Yeah. How wonderful to write something and know that it will go to all those
Those
people,
people.
not your organization of 600 people. 200 of whom will look at it right away, and the other people will stick it in a pile.
Well, and I think the listserv does that on a certain ex to a certain extent. It's created a commu a international community
Absolutely.
that blows me away. When I started to get, I think I've been involved with it since as soon as I got a computer, I think in '93.
I could let you know if you haven't unsubscribed and resubscribed if you really want to.
Well, I don't think I have, but my initial, I might have, because initially I shared an email with my husband, and then it was clear I had to get my own. So it might be under his name some of the earliest times. But I think the thing about the bone folder is it gave the opportunity to really explore things in depth in a way, and visually they were very compelling, whereas the online interface for the listserv is very utilitarian, but it's hard to read. If it goes on to, there are people, and I'm sure you know, that go on and on and on and on.
Guilty.
Well, we all do, but I actually can't even handle the digest because it's easier for me to process what's there by getting
The individual
the
messages.
individual messages, and that way I can process it if it's information I need for my students or for me. I actually have a whole sub fold, a whole series of subfolders on my email thing, whatever it is, the email service
I'm
with.
impressed.
Yeah, no, because I need to know where, even if it's, especially because I'm teaching, I feel like I may not know need to know where to have a die made, but I'm going to need to know that to give that information to someone, and the listserv's a great place for that. But it, and it, as I said, the digest just kind of makes me want to go to bed. It's too much. But
But you talk about the distribution, and
and that,
as part of this big experiment, one of the things that I was very fortunate to have been aware of was, for example, the Directory of Open Access Journals, which is international. But what it does is when you enter information, and I basically enter descriptive information for each and every article, that will show up in just about every major, and by major I mean college, research, academic library, some of the bigger public systems, library catalogs. So if somebody is searching for book arts, chances are they will find something through the Directory of Open Access Journals that will point to us. And at the same time, you know, we've ceased publication. It's still available. I've been fortunate that Syracuse is hosting it. I'm making use of the Internet Archive as well. But LOX, which is, you know, lots of copies keep stuff safe, which is one of these academic library projects of long-term digital archiving. And we're in that as well. So, you know, it's really laying the groundwork for, A, making sure that people can find the content, even if they've never heard of the book arts, the lists, the journals, or anything, just by searching their catalog, but also that it remains available for the long term.
Interesting. I think that that's actually maybe, you know, are you ever going to take it down was one of my questions. I sort of assumed not, but it's interesting to see that it's going to be living in all these different places.
I have no plans to, you know, to close my website down, which it links from. But I also know that if I ever do, I will put in place mechanisms to ensure that it will live on.
Right.
I've got a question for Peter.
Uh-oh.
Go.
Or the other people on the board, if you know what they're doing. I have not printed out any of the bone folders in their final form to bind or do anything with. Have you?
I have, with all the issues except the last two or the last one, and I actually took them to Kinko's and just had them velo bound, and they're just printed out on my laser printer, not in color. I have toyed with the thought, and this would just be more work. If somebody really wanted to do it and work with me, I'd be happy to, you know, accept that help. But, you know, putting it up on Lulu, for example,
that's a great idea.
Print on demand, and then just making it at cost or something.
I think that's
it'd be great.
You can do it at cost, and you can also do it as a free download. Which it already is, but that's another place for it to be.
I wouldn't do it at Lulu for as a free download, although there's no harm in doing that. But I think the print-on-demand function is more interesting because the color reproductions, and that's, you know, when we were producing it, this last issue, the raw file for this was close to 75 megabytes. And I was having, I don't want to say a breakdown, but I was really challenged in how to crunch it down to a manageable download. And 22 megabytes is pretty hefty without sacrificing too much of the image quality.
Right. That's something I hadn't even considered.
That was always a consideration. And, you know, after an issue came out, it was never very many, but I always got some people who would say, my computer's choking on this. Is there another way I can get it?
Oh, interesting. I personally have printed out some of the ones in the beginning, and that it was always something I wanted to do, like print them all out, and then it was a project that went to the bottom of the pile, but it's something I've been thinking about. And I'm pretty sure in the resource room at Columbia College they have them all printed out.
Interesting. Good.
I'm pretty sure.
We should remind people about the index, Peter.
Yes.
Tell me about the index.
I actually had a student of mine who is in library school now, Samantha Quell, took an indexing class and was, you know, looking for projects. And I said, well, if you really have nothing else that you can do, there's this journal that you've enjoyed. And she said, oh, okay. So she did an issue for the first seven issues, and then, you know, when it was clear that we were going to be winding it down, I got in touch with her and said, you know, would you be willing to do one including the eighth? And she said, absolutely. And I sent her a draft of it about 2 or 3 weeks before we released the issue, which worked out fine for her indexing purposes. And she did that, and we were able to put a complete index online as well.
Oh, that's great.
And I
That's
think the
great.
index works really well.
That makes it actually a very interesting resource that you can that you have an index, because that's such a huge undertaking.
Yeah, and I was very fortunate and very grateful that she was able to do that.
Cool. Interesting. So I'm sort of still thinking about the print on demand aspect, because that's a really interesting idea, and I think that it would basically finding a size like on Lulu, and from my experience, which is not that extensive, they have the biggest variety of sizes that I was aware of that you just it, you
Well,
might
it's eight
already.
and a half by 11. It's easy.
Right.
It's a
So I
no-brainer for them.
right, it should be pretty easy. You have to is it in a PDF form? It is in a PDF form. So you
Yes.
might, yeah, I just as I said it, I realized what I was saying.
But you just need to go through and then, make sure that everything's there. You need to create a cover for it. You might want to say, okay, we will produce it in volumes. So volume one will include issues numbers one and two,
Those are all
et
decisions.
cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it's something that someone needs to do, and I may well at some point in time do it. Somebody may say, I'd love to, put these things together for you and put them up online. I'm open to that, but I'll be perfectly honest, right now it's not a priority. And I think if binders, book artists, and anyone else wants to print it out and bind them, go for it. As a shoemaker, my kids are all barefoot, and so am I. But there was an interesting call for doing the next Binderama on binding all the issues that came out on the book arts list. Somebody made that suggestion, and that was nice. I chuckled.
That's kind of a nice thought.
It's a nice thought. I don't think it's going to happen unless somebody else wants to take the lead on it.
Well, it is just thinking about it, like, what if you chose an alternative structure for the bone folder, like the flag book?
That'd be a pretty big flag book.
It would be humongous, but it's a really funny idea
Sure,
too.
why not?
Absolutely. I think we might have reached our last question, unless you all have anything else that you want to contribute to what we've been talking about tonight.
I think if I were to say anything, it would be thank you to all the people that worked on it. Karen's here with me now, but Danya Khan, Pamela Berrios, Chayla Metzger, Don Rash, and Anne McKierney, they all made real contributions to it. And, especially to all the people who wrote for it. We couldn't have done it without them. And I think we were really, really lucky that people responded so well to being asked, but then also submitted of their own accord. And I know that that's not necessarily the case across the board with other publications. And then to the readers. And it's been, I think for me, it was an amazing experiment. And it's something that if I look back on the work that I've done, is probably on a certain level, perhaps more meaningful to me than the list and the website.
Really, why is that?
I think because it just seems more permanent.
Huh.
Emails, even though it's all archived, seem very ephemeral. The website evolves, it grows, it's very organic, but this was something that was, conceived of as an entity. And yes, it grew organically in some respects, but we really knew what we wanted to do, how we wanted to do it. We had a plan. For me, I think it means an awful lot to have had these people to work with. In some cases, we didn't really know each other that well, and it was an incredible opportunity to just really get to know amazing people out there that I might not have otherwise.
Well, I know for me it was an incredible opportunity to really, start to write in a more serious way. And
Yeah,
the thing
I
about
still remember hitting you up for that article at Starbucks in Philly.
that's right, during the hybrid book.
Exactly.
So, and it was interesting because it really was something that I was really interested in. So it was really fun for me to be able to pursue it. And the other thing I think is really interesting, there's this academic website called Academia.edu, and I've put the articles I've written for Bonefolder on there because you have an opportunity to do that. And I'm constantly getting emails from them saying, someone just searched for you. And when I click on the keywords, inevitably it's one of the articles I've written for Bonefolder.
Excellent.
That's really kind of been a fascinating tie-in. So, well, I think that's pretty much it for tonight.
Any parting words, Karen?
Sure. It's of all the things I've done that aren't my personal work, it's the best thing I've been involved with.
Well, that's so nice.
Because it was a way to reach and serve so many people, and with the great variety of articles we have, I hope that it helped introduce people to different disciplines. Maybe conservators got to respect book artists a little more. Book artists got to find out a little more about fancy binding and respect those people. So, it's been really important, and I'm honored to have been part of it.
I kind of feel the same way. I feel really honored to be part of it as well, and really happy to have had an opportunity to speak with both of you tonight
Thank you.
about the Bone Folder and its history.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much. Good
Thanks,
night. Good
Mimi.
night.
Good
Bye.
night.
Bye.